This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me, as usual, is Richard Halls.
Hello, everybody.
And this week, we are reviewing The Drone. We'll also be looking at The Night Sitter. Our short shot is Perps, and we're going to round off with our DTV throwback, Redline. So, let's crack on. So, our first review is The Drone. When Rachel and Chris move into their high-tech dream home, they discover that the previous owner seems to have left a drone. Chris is ecstatic to have a new man toy to play with, while Rachel is rather not amused. It isn't long, though, before strange things start happening and the drone starts popping up where no one left it. Is someone else controlling the drone? Or is it something even more sinister and crazy? It's not just crazy, is it, Rich? This is batshit crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, off the bat, you know, if a film is called The Drone and it's about a killer drone, you kind of know what you're in for. I think all things considered, it does what it sets out to do really well. I think the tone is a bit muddled because the plot is basically Child's Play redone.
It is Child's Play, yeah, basically.
The concept, many films have been made about killer robots and stuff, and that they all just take a different approach. And this, for the most part, does play it very straight, but it's almost like they want to, rather than being a deadpan comedy, they have to shoehorn in some, like, really obvious jokes.
Some really,
really
off-color jokes as well. I mean, one of the first lines of dialogue is after the SWAT team come in and find, you know, the latest victim, and somebody goes, oh, she should have swiped left or something. And I think, Jesus, that's a really bad case of victim blaming. It's really horrible.
Yeah, there's quite a few jokes that are sort of a bit like that, I think, throughout it. But there's the tone does sort of shift because you get that the first joke is kind of the killer is just about to be caught and he's like, oh no, I should have rung an Uber. Yeah. Or something, and it's like, oh, hang on, that's a bit weird. And then it's like, Cleary. And then the cops come, and there's various things that they say. And then one of the cops is talking to his child on the phone. Oh, and it's like a full-on, it's the conversation is like a full-on airplane, you know, Captain Over kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where the kid is knows too much.
Way too much. But that actually reminded me of, what's the name of the author? Elroy? The guy did L.A. Confidential and things.
James Ellroy.
Yeah, James Ellroy. There's one of his films called Cop. It was based on his
film. James Woods.
James Woods. Because that character was very much like that. You know, he'd come home at night, you know, tuck his daughter into bed and then tell her about all the horrible cases that he was working on. Which I thought was quite funny. So, but yeah, she's almost like his psychiatrist, isn't she?
Yeah, but that's kind of a throwaway scene, and we move on to the next. And there's peppered humour, like the next door neighbour and all the inappropriate stuff she keeps saying and whatnot, and other bits and the silly death scenes and stuff like that. But by the time you get to like the very end of the movie, it ends on a really sort of serious note. Mm. It's not the kind of humorous payoff. You know, you would expect it's kind of it's almost as though they were undecided whether they wanted it to be a serious movie or not, or you know, at least deadpan. Mm. That was quite strange, but it does. Overall, I did really enjoy it. I thought they did a good job. I mean, it is fun. It's silly. It's quite low budget, but they do it quite well. The drone itself, you know, looks like every common or garden drone, but they do make the killing stuff quite funny. There is a bit where the drone, they don't show it doing it, but the drone has laid out candles and petals and stuff.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting to see how he did that. Yeah.
Oh, there was another thing where sometimes you see, like, you know, like in the Terminator, where the sort of the vision and the stats and things come up. Mm. And there was I paused what it was saying on this blink and you'll miss it bit of text that came up. And it's all the words are all together with no spacing or anything. And it says stuff like, get me out of this flying prison. What I'd give to have my old body back or something. And, do robots dream of a life? I sure don't. Which I thought that was quite a nice little attention for detail, sort of Easter egg thing that put me, but I don't know how many people would actually bother to pause that, but it sort of caught my notice. Dragging the when the drone is attacking the one young woman and dragging her by her hair and stuff, I thought that was clearly the drone would not have the strength to do that, but it's all part of the fun, you know?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm with you for most of the way on this, I agree. And, you know, the insidious way that the drone manages to sort of drive a wedge between Rachel and Chris, you know, taking photographs of the neighbor, then posting them to, you know, on her computer and things, or on his computer, but in a big file so she can find it, sort of thing, you know, in the middle of the screen, which is quite amusing. So, yeah, I liked all that stuff. It was just the end, I just felt it pushed it a little bit too far.
Do you mean like the final scene?
Yeah, the final bit, you know.
I thought that was unnecessary and kind of ruined it a bit. It wasn't necessary. And it didn't actually add that much, apart from to actually make it really downbeat.
Exactly, yeah. It took the fun out of it, in a way. But for the most part, the film that this kind of reminded me of was Bad Samaritan, you know, the one with David Tennant?
Yeah, I haven't caught that yet.
Yeah, it has that sort of thing. And, you know, obviously the sort of child's play and things like that. But it's just the idea that, you know, this guy's whole life is being messed with, you know, by this thing in a very plausible way. And, like, you know, when the police turn up and they've got sort of, you know, quite good grounds to be asking questions by that point. So yeah, I quite like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've done... There were films that have done sort of similar stuff like this in the past. There was one called Ghost in the Machine from, like, 1993, directed by... Rachel Tulele, which was a big 20, you know, it was a 20th century Fox movie. It's quite big, but that had lots of, you know, it was a serial killer. He dies, he goes into the computer and he can start controlling electronic devices and that. And that is what was done. I mean, especially with the recent Child's Play remake.
They
dropped the killer goes into the body thing, but they amped up the controlling other devices. So these guys live in a house with, electronic security measures, so, you know, he can tap into that and he can link up to the people. There's lots of elements where they use the electronic sort of connections and Wi-Fi and that to do a bit more with the idea than it just being a drone flying around.
Yeah, which I liked as well. You know, I like the fact that you know the drone's just sitting there, but at the same time he's recording them, tapping in their security passcodes and things like that, you know, sort of getting hold of all this information. I mean, one of the things...
I thought that was quite subtle.
Yeah.
That bit you just mentioned there, I thought that was quite subtly done. I thought that worked well.
I did. The other bit I liked, you know, which just sort of showed how nasty it can be, was you see it sort of browsing through all these sort of like sort of vets and places, you know, who put down dogs and things like that. And you think, well, surely he's not going to call the thing, but he just leaves it on his browsing history for her to find. So, you know, she thinks that he's thinking about getting rid of the dog, sort of thing, you know. It's just one of those, another sort of nice sort of psychological twist of the knife, sort of thing. But yeah, so this is, you know, it's not a mega budget one, as you say. It's all centered around this one house. Very nice house it is, too. But it works really well. Character-wise, I think Rachel is meant to be some sort of architect/designer, whereas Chris is a fashion photographer, and you know, he's one of these sort of artists who insists on wearing a scarf all the time, which I thought was quite amusing. You know, you see all these sort of actors and things, sort of, you know, always wrapping the scarf around the neck. I just thought it was quite amusing. But there you go. But yeah, so overall, quite like this. So I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
I'm going to, just for the fact that, because I think it's very good. I think it's smarter than you might initially give it, you know, that you might initially give it credit for. I certainly did. It's got nice little knots and nice little touches. The tonal, you know, problems in some instances, especially at the end, dropped it down for me, so I'm taking it down to a 6.
Yeah, I forgot about that end bit. I'm reviewing my decision. You're right, that ending does sort of cost it a mark. So yeah, I'm giving it a 6 as well. So 2 6s for The Drone. Now, this is currently a rental, or is it available on Now TV, I think you said?
Yeah, if you've got Sky Cinema or Now TV, you can see it on there. Otherwise, it's available to rent at all the usual
outlets. Quite cheap. It's quite cheap on Amazon at the moment, I think. Okay, before we get into our next review, I'd just like to point out that we are on Twitter and Facebook, where we put some very interesting information regarding the UK Top 100 and where the DTVs fit into that. Also, we pop on some trailers that we like the look of now and again, so please check us out, the DTV Digest on Twitter and Facebook. Right, on to the Night Sitter. A young woman called Amber arrives at a huge house to babysit 2 young kids, Kevin and his friend Ronnie, while their parents go out on a date. It's not long before Amber reveals her true reason for being there, but it turns out there may be something even more nightmarish for them all to be dealing with. So this is under the banner of Fright Fest Presents, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty decent little horror movie. It is a little horror movie. Reminded me a bit of the We Summon the Darkness that we covered the other week in you know, the setting. Also, Satanic Panic is another sort of touchdown for this. But I quite like this overall. You know, there's some nice sort of comedic moments to it. The character of Amber, although she's a bit of a shit, is actually, you know, quite likable at the same time. And young Kevin actually sort of he grows on you as well. So yeah, I was quite happy to watch this.
You mentioned there are quite a few similar, you know, films that were similar, and we covered Summon the Darkness. Yeah, that did cross We Summon the Darkness. Yeah, that did cross my mind as well. I couldn't quite think of why, but I think, you know, it was partly the way the film was shot. But also, yeah, as you say, a lot of it's set around a house. Takes place there. Now, you know a lot more about, you know, horror movie classics probably than I do. This film references or has as their villains the Three Mothers, and it's shot in a very colourful style. Is it or is that not taken from Dario Argento's Suspiria?
Yes, it's a big nod towards Argento's Three Mothers trilogy, as it's known, which is Inferno, Suspiria, and eventually the Mother of Tears. Yes, it's a big nod to that. And then the colour scheme, as you mentioned, there's lots of reds and greens throughout the film, you know, so the way it's lit. Definitely a big nod in that direction.
And we've also got, I mean, it's not a goblin type score, but we do have a retro synth soundtrack, which is quite good. Now, it was partly due to the characters of, you know, you were saying how the heroine of the film, what was her name? Laura? Amber, sorry.
She calls herself Amber to the kids. And that.
Yeah. That she was reasonably likable. But I didn't really like her, and I didn't really like any of the other characters much either. The thing is, it's so similar in many respects to The Babysitter.
Yes, that is another one. Yep.
And it compares quite unfavorably to that, because that was such a good film. the emphasis there, I mean, the main heroine of that film wasn't a very nice character either. Mm. And the boy was, you know, the boy was a nice guy. But in this case, they've not focused on the boy. They're focused on not the villain of the piece, but, you know, the
she's definitely characters. An anti-heroine, yeah.
Anti-hero, yeah. She's not really redeemed by the end of the movie. Nothing really changes that much. She actually, you know, she's the reason everyone gets killed, mm-hmm. basically. And the main guy is quite... We get introduced to the guy whose house it is, the paranormal investigator. We don't quite get... He's sort of broadly drawn, you know, comical sort of character. Mm-hmm. And when it all goes pear-shaped, he's actually... You know, it's not the worst thing in the world as far as he's concerned, because he's just, you know, loves the occult, and he's desperate for experience of it, and he wants to launch this TV show and stuff. But the only character that sort of appealed or was, you know, particularly well drawn for me was the neighbor from across the street who lives in his garage.
Yeah.
who turns out to be that guy in the horror movie who knows everything that's happening because he just happens to be an expert in witchcraft.
He was really good, actually, yeah.
So there's a sort of, I don't know, he's kind of like a character in a Ricky Gervais thing or something, you know, like in Afterlife, just like an embarrassing character in the background. But he sort of made it a bit more novel. So the boy doesn't really get enough to do to be appealing as like the main character in the same sense of something like The Gate with Stephen Dorff or whatever. The overall, I did watch the whole thing, I wasn't drawn in the same way that something like We Summon the Darkness or especially The Babysitter did. Mm. And so this comes across as, you know, like a poor relation.
Yeah, I certainly, you know, get where you're coming from, and I think with the character of Amber, you know, she is a bad egg, but there's something about the way she deals with people. I mean, you know, she's a bad egg straight away when the guy's asking for her references and things. She's going, oh yeah, you know, I left him at home, or you know, yeah, okay, and. But it's just the way she deals with other people in her life and how sort of whiny and crappy they are that puts her in a better light, basically. You know, the boyfriend guy was, you know, when he's on the phone to her and he's saying, I love you, and she's going, yeah, I like you. He goes, no, I love you. And she's like, you know, just hang up. And the other two who come to help rob the house... Yeah, you know, she's in control, basically. She's the one, you know.
Yeah.
So she gets a bit of sympathy, and the fact that she doesn't try and bullshit Kevin about what's happening. You know, doesn't try to sugarcoat it, going, don't worry, your dad's rich, he's fine. You know, he's not going to miss too much of what we're nicking.
But again, that was kind of that disappointed, because why does the kid just sort of go along with it? It's like, oh, yeah, it's fine. Well, you thought you'd have kicked off or try and rung his dad or something. It's like, I don't know why, I guess, you know, there's like a lot of backstory that's not really elaborated on, you know, his mother died or whatever, and why doesn't he like his dad? Why doesn't he? Why is he quite happy for stuff to happen?
Yeah, I think his dad sort of enables his state of being, you know. And his dad doesn't really realise how much trouble he's in. You know, he's aware that he's been, you know, that the sort of forces of darkness are circling around his son, kind of thing. But he's sort of enabling it and encouraging it, you know. But he sets things up in a way that he thinks are going to go down a certain road, and of course they don't, you know, get screwed up. It's quite interesting. I kind of ended up I did like Amber. And I don't know if it's just because she's pretty or, you know, or just sort of her acerbic nature. But, you know, I was willing to sort of go along with her plans.
How did she get the job? That's what I can figure out as well. Because if she's, you know, not a trustworthy individual, how would she even end up there?
I think that's part of the point. She's someone nobody's going to miss. You know, I think that was part of the plan, is that, you know, well, she is sketchy, and no one's got any references for her or anything like that. You know, she's new to the area, so no one's going to ask too many questions if she disappears.
Yeah,
that's the way I read it anyway, because I had the dad down pat straight away. You know, leaving a box out with a big X on it.
You know? Well, he was very dodgy. You know, he's offering her a whiskey and stuff when she arrives.
Straight away, very, very dodgy. So I think the execution lets the film down a bit. The whole thing with these three witches. And while I was watching it, I'm thinking, why do they have such a convoluted plan? Really, you know. Why the flickering lights in the garage? Why do that? You know, you could overcome all these people straight away and would have a 5-minute film, but we've got to drag it out. You know, so we're going to do spooky stuff in the attic or in the garage or something. You know, without actually revealing ourselves until we decide to. Okay, it's very sort of they're not thinking straight, basically. And it shows, but yeah. So it's not, you know, I made a few examples earlier, and it is that sort of film, but possibly not as good as those films. You know, I'd probably put it towards the bottom of the pack.
There's one more reference of a similar kind of film that I just want to throw in there in case anybody hasn't seen it: The House of the Devil, directed by Ty West,
which is another. I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it is worth seeing. I mean, it's a very retro, same kind of concept of.
Again, it's one of those films I'm very aware of, you know, and I'm quite aware of what happens in it, but I just haven't got around to see it. It's probably because I know everything that happens in it, you know. But there you go. But yeah, no, I like Ty West, so that is other stuff. So, yeah.
Anyway, how should we score this one then? Right?
I think this is going to come in at a 6 as well.
For me, because I was so middle of the road and not really committed to it, either way, I'm going for a 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's actually Jack Champion who plays Kevin is the one that saves this one. There's a couple of scenes which are similar to, or in the same vein as, The Sixth Sense, where it was Haley Joel Osment sort of going, I see dead people, and sort of telling stuff to Bruce Willis. He manages to have that same sort of bit of gravitas when he's sort of telling Amber about his dreams and what's been happening in the house. So, yeah, he manages to give it a bit of atmosphere. So he saves it, and I like Elise Duthar is the woman who plays Amber. I thought she was very good in it as well.
The production design with the drawing. And stuff and the book, the special effects and that are all really well done. The aesthetic way it's all shot and everything. I would say, you know, there's a lot to recommend it if you like this sort of movie.
So that is a 5 and a 6 for The Night Sitter. Our short shot this week is Perps. After coming out of a movie theatre, two stoners encounter a cop on the verge of a nervous breakdown and become victims of his vented anger. In order to placate him, the pair make a deal to help him in a spot of revenge. So this is a nice 10-minute short, short bunch of characters, really well produced, really well lit, and funny as hell. What this reminded me of very much is the film War on Everyone.
I haven't seen that.
It's got a very sort of similar sort of feel to that, you know, these sort of very loose cannon cops just you know, flaunting their authority and responsibility to a ridiculous measure. How did you feel about this one?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I wasn't sure at first what I could, knowing the theme was, you know, the characters were stoners, but that's really not a big thing. It's like they like smoke. They smoke like a little bit at the start, and that's like an inciting sort of moment. But it doesn't really go beyond that. So they're just a couple of, you know, Tucker and Dale kind of sort of characters. You know, so they're not really like Jay and Silent Bob or anything.
No, or, nothing like that.
But the guy who plays the cop having the breakdown was really good. You know, his delivery is like so over the top and everything, and then he's got his partner with him who's like trying to keep holding together.
Yeah.
And the sort of situation escalates. You know, it's a very small story. It's about 9 minutes. They meet, encounter this cop, and they get arrested. They go to car, and they propose this deal. And then we end. You know, we get to the final part of the story, and there's sort of like a payoff. And it's quite an unusual ending because it's kind of open ended. It's not really. There's not a huge amount that's solved or anything. It's just kind of a bit of a rambling, not a Shaggy Dog story, but you know, that kind of thing.
It's a sort of thing. It's sort of a story that these two guys are going to be telling down the pub for the rest of their
life. Yeah, it does have a kind of an air of that. And of course, the sort of big payoff at the end is a cameo by a rather well known personality.
Well, let's say who it is, because it's fucking Lou Ferrigno.
Ferrigno,
even. Yeah. You know me, my pronunciation. I think I've always called him Ferrigno ever since watching.
They pronounce it wrong in the film as well, which is a joke.
Yeah. But how old is he now?
Oh, gosh.
Exactly.
I mean,
he looks amazing in this
film. He always has. I mean, there's some videos out there that say, when did he look at, when was he at his peak? Was it in the 70s? Never the 80s or the 90s, and even now it's when he's been around for 5 decades,
exactly.
And he's still taking care of himself, still a very imposing presence, one of the tallest bodybuilders, I believe, during his time. Still very imposing. You know, recently he's had quite a lot of roles and stuff, like one of the Scorpion King sequels and that, but also turning up in short films like this. And you know that it adds. You know, I wouldn't say watch the film just for him, but him being in it is a nice cameo sort of bonus.
It's a nice bit of icing on the cake, certainly.
Yeah.
And he's really, really good. You know, he gets a few lines. But I mean, you know, I saw him in Instant Death, 2017, and he looked.
Yeah.
Obviously, the character looked. You know, he's meant to look a lot rougher in that film, but. But yeah, you know, he's all cleaned up and everything. You think women are just going to be falling for him left, right, and centre. You know, he must be beating them off with a stick the whole time. But this is a good sort of funny little film. There's a sort of weird sequence where basically the two stoners, they pick up one of them sort of saying, yeah, he's a karate black belt or something. You know, you got to see what he can do. And there's this sort of montage of them breaking boards and bricks and all the rest.
Oh, that's good, yeah. And the Godzilla
music
and stuff, or the sound effects.
Sound effects.
Yeah, that was a good. That's a good little sequence, though.
But then it's an even better for me. There was an even better sequence when they pull up to the house, and the music segues into Dirty Harry.
Oh, see, I wouldn't have even got that.
No, it becomes Layla Schifrin's score for Dirty Harry when he whacks the car to set off the car alarm and all that sort of stuff. So I was like, yeah, nice one. I thought it was really cool. So yeah, no, I thought this was very, very well done, very clever. Some really good comedy moments in it. Can't really say much more than that, but we'll put the short in the footnotes. There'll be a link. So check it out. 10 minutes long. Can't go wrong. Our DTV throwback this week is Redline. Natasha is a talented musician / mechanic / driver, and is in a punk. Well, she is. Now we're going to come on to something in a minute, aren't we? Anyway. So she's a talented musician / mechanic / driver and is enticed into the world of illegal drag racing by her new manager, Infamous, played by Eddie Griffin. Meanwhile, a Marine called Carlo has just returned from active duty and meets up with his younger brother, Jason, also a drag racer and working for their uncle, Michael, played by Angus McFadden. With the stakes reaching live... I'll put live there. With the stakes reaching life or death levels, the racing starts to take a deadly turn. Okay, so I kind of hated this movie. I must admit, I really did. It sort of sits between in the sort of timeline. You had Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift, mm-hmm. and then this came out between that film and Fast and Furious, which is Furious 4 as we know it. So it's kind of cashing in on that, and I suppose Need for Speed came out around about the same sort of time as well. But Rich, you were sort of telling me that this film is a bit of a passion project for its producer.
Yeah, so the film was made at the whim of its producer creator Daniel Sedak, who comes up at the beginning. It says Daniel Sedak presents. Mm. He sank his own money into the film and his own cars.
Yes.
Because he'd made a huge amount of money from financial dealings in what was called the subprime mortgages. I don't know, scandal almost. I don't know. It was a big thing that contributed to the financial crash in America, which I don't understand at all. But it seems to be that he kind of exploited a situation, made a huge amount of money, and, you know, was able to buy all these, you know, expensive supercars and then, you know, make a movie in which he basically trashed some of them. intentionally or not, because I think Eddie Griffin actually crashed one of his Ferraris, you know, when he wasn't supposed to. But there is a scene in the movie where they trash. I can't remember which car it is, but they like literally spin it through the air. And it looks like a bad CGI shot or something, but it was done for real. And this is like $500,000 car. The annoying thing is that it doesn't look good in the film. A lot of the car stunts and you know, whatever, look a bit shoddy. It's not a good film. It's not a good film at all. But I think it's an interesting film for its place in sort of history and the, let's say, this sort of vanity project kind of. Or the origin sort of story of it. But you've got people like Tim Matheson from Animal House and various other things.
I was wondering if Tim Matheson's character was meant to be a substitute, a surrogate for the producer.
I think, in a way, yes. Actually, Daniel appears in the poker scene near the start or middle. Hmm. There's a very, you know, high stakes gambling scene and Daniel's sitting next to me. He's the guy with the lank black hair and the beard.
Who
they make a point of saying, "I'll see you later," kind of thing. But that's like his little cameo. But yeah, Matheson's, you know, he's giving it his all. He's not phoning it in or something. No, and Angus McFadden isn't either.
Yeah, I liked Tim Matheson's character because he plays this movie producer / director who is a successful gambler and, you know, can quite comfortably sort of throw his money around, whereas Angus McFadden's character, Uncle Mike, he's sort of in a lot of trouble. You know, he needs a big win. He owes some very shady people a lot of money, so he's in a sort of bad place. A lot of his backstory isn't really sort of fleshed out either. He gets a couple of sinister phone calls to sort of, which, you know, kind of shows his sort of motivation. Then he got Eddie Griffin's character, who's just sort of a chancer, basically, who's like, you know, got three million quid to play with, and that's it, and then loses it. So that's quite amusing.
But McFadden's character is also that aspect of, you know, the getting in trouble and, you know, in over his head stuff. So that's kind of shoehorned in to just sort of, oh, we've got to actually make him much more of a baddie in the story. But he's having a lot of fun with the role, giving his character all these. I don't know how much of it is in the script, but he's like a really kooky guy. He's like really weird. And so those guys sort of anchor the film, really, but they're not the main stars. The film itself weaves all over the place in lots of different directions. It starts out with narration from its lead actress, played by Nadia Bjorlin, who was Daniel Sedak's girlfriend, who's, as you say, she runs around. I don't understand it. She must have inherited it from her father who died, because there's like a trauma about her father dying. So it's Nat's garage, but her mum works there. So obviously he didn't leave it to his wife. He left it to his daughter. And also she sings in a band as well. And so she gets to show off in some singing scenes, but the songs are really bad. There's like two songs. They both sound terrible and the lyrics are awful. And then she's a fantastic driver as well. So, and then all the characters, so they introduce loads and loads of characters with these like pre-Israel intros and the character names and stuff. One of whom is Carlo, who is Michael's nephew, who's back from the war, or back from tour of duty at least. And he doesn't really get many scenes until like half an hour into the movie when he becomes a bit more important. And as the plot unfolds, you know, it becomes a revenge story. But even that, it doesn't really go. There's a scene where he goes and meets Louis Mandylor.
Yeah.
And gets tooled up. But that, and then you think, oh, there's going to be a big, you know, big raid on the compound, rescue scene, commando scene, whatever. But that part of the story is over really quickly. And then it's kind of forgotten about. Even Nadia, who's sort of tied, you know, she's caught up in the whole thing. Because that, I'll take a step back, because Carlo and Nadia cross paths initially when he sort of notices her at a party or something, and a guy starts hassling her and he steps in. And they don't even talk, but she remembers him later as the guy who stood in to protect her. And then that becomes a theme throughout the movie, that he's like rescuing her or helping her at various parts. And so theirs becomes kind of the central relationship, even though the film just meanders away to focus on like Eddie Griffin and stuff. It's directed by Andy Chen, who is probably, I most well know him as one of the guys, one of the fantastic fighters in US Seals 2. He's one of Jackie Chan's stunt team. He's done, you know, fight coordination and stunt choreography on absolutely tons of stuff, including Welcome to the Jungle, where I think he met Ernie Reyes Jr., who has a neat little fight scene later in the movie. Cheng actually himself has a little Hitchcock-like cameo where Carlo, you know, beats him up basically, which is completely unconvincing.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no
boxing fight. Ring sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a total vanity project. I think if you're interested in cars, you might like it, but even car fans I know have taken issue with it quite a lot. But
the cars aren't really in it much, and the racing is sort of pared down to the minimum. I think there's as much time, screen time, paid to watching the people watching the race as there is the people actually racing. And you hardly get any shots inside the cars. It's like they couldn't even bother to try and convince you that there was anyone any of the actors driving the cars at all. You know, very few sort of shots to sort of say, oh yeah, we actually put them in the front seat and made them drive. You know, it's all very sort of dark windows and sort of shot from a distance and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, they've had poured a fair amount of money into this, but I think they certainly must have cut corners in some ways, and as you say, a lot of it is watching the race, you know, dealing with the characters who are a bit like, you know, like Godzilla, the Gareth Edwards or you know, Godzilla, where Godzilla actually doesn't really appear very much. Most of it is people talking about Godzilla. But the one thing that really bugs me about the movie, which is really it's kind of a hymn to excess. Which is, you know, all these guys with literally more, you know, well, Michael in his case has literally got more money than sense. He has no sense whatsoever. But, you know, they're just betting exorbitant amounts of money these like vanity things, but not caring about other people, even the lead characters, you know, like the Nadia Borland, Natalie, her character, you know, she's supposed to be like sympathetic and so is Carlo. But come the end of the movie, they're both like street racing with these, you know, supercars that they've just been given without a care for anyone who's getting in their way or whatever, you know, almost causing accidents. At one point in one of the street races, there's a, you know, and a car hits a van and the van goes flying, and it echoes a scene that was in Charlie's Angels, which has always been like one of my big bugbears of, you know, of that film, which is quite a light film or whatever, but it's just like they literally don't put any thought into the fact that, hang on a minute, that's an innocent person or people in that car who've just been killed. because it's not even paid any attention to. It's like, we don't care. Right.
At least, you know, at least there's a bit more sort of care and attention paid in the sort of Fast and Furious movies, you know, and people do take the piss out of the fifth one, you know, and the safe being dragged along the street and stuff. But for the most part, you know, this sort of takes place on deserted roads and things like that.
Yeah, stuff like that, yeah.
But the thing about this film, as you mentioned, you know, there is that sort of collateral damage element, you know, when they're in the street race and there's people in the way getting, you know, cars smashed and everything. The end of the film, after the baddies have been caught and everything, and all the dust has settled, the two main characters, which is Carlo and Nadja, get in equal, you know, Ferraris, one red, one yellow, and do the same fucking thing. They're driving, you know, down this freeway, sort of zooming in and out of cars and things, putting everyone at risk when there's absolutely no stakes at all.
No.
You know,
and it doesn't even have a payoff. It's literally payoff just, that is a scene just to show off, that's just for the sake of it at the end of the movie. But yeah, that scene, which is the one I was alluding to a minute ago when we were talking, you know, there's a bit where they come out onto the freeway or whatever, and, you know, a car literally has to sort of spin.
Yeah, yeah. And that's
because right. they've cut him up. It's like, and they go, yeah, isn't it great? Oh, we only care about ourselves. It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Given the way losers, we've got Ferraris. You know, it's that a sort of attitude. You know, the road is ours, even though it's like rush hour. It's, so overall, this is, I found it difficult to watch. I watched it all in one sitting somehow. You know, it takes a while to settle on which characters it wants you to follow as well. You know, there's a whole bit with Eddie Griffin's character where he's on the plane and he's trying to be, I even forgot which character it is now on the Fast and Furious ones. There's a couple of black guys and he's trying to be both of them. You know, there's a bit where he's chatting to this girl, or, you know, he's chatting to Nadja and one of his other women starts getting uppity, so he basically lands the plane and chucks her off.
Yeah.
And takes off again.
Call this plane over right now. Yeah. And they literally do. It reminded me, there's a scene in, I think it was Cannonball, it was like the third Cannonball Run, but it was released as like Cannonball Fever. I'm sure there's a scene in that where there's a plane that lands or takes off on a road or something. But this one's done like really cheap.
Yeah,
it's like you don't even actually see it on the road or anything. It's all cutaways and visual effects. But that in itself adds to the. I think that's why I like the film, even though it's not good. It's that there's a playfulness to it. There's all these wipes and stuff. Yeah. You know, it's not over taking itself too seriously. It's a bit lost in itself.
Yes,
a bit, you know, vainglorious or whatever. But yeah, I got this when it came out. I originally had it on an import. It came out in like 2007, but it didn't come out in the UK until about 2011 from Signature Entertainment. And I initially saw it in a supermarket. I think it was Tesco. So it was like an exclusive. Mm. It's like a supermarket exclusive for at least some time. And then recently I thought, you know, I really wouldn't mind revisiting that. So I picked it up in CEX for like 50p. And then now, all of a sudden, now, you know, having not been available anywhere, it's turned up on Amazon Prime now.
Yeah. It's kind of like the, was it Detox that we viewed a while back?
Yeah.
Now turning up on Netflix as I see.
Yeah. The weird thing is there, as an aside, the film is called Detox. It comes up as Detox on the film. So why list ICU?
Even on Netflix, it comes up as Detox in the credits.
In the credits on the film, yeah. It comes up at the beginning, Detox, which I thought...
These people sort of pausing the film and going, no, it's the wrong one. I want to watch the other one.
God. But anyway, that's an aside. So that's a curiosity. So not one we'd recommend per se, but certainly got some interesting aspects.
We're making you aware of its presence, basically.
Doesn't Lewis Mandalore look like a young version of Sue from the Deck Collector?
He really does. Yeah. He's got the blonde hair and everything. So it's there. Red line. You know, if you like cars, you want to sort of see what a train wreck looks like. You could do worse. I did like the fight scenes for what they were.
Well, it's Andy Cheng. You've got to expect
It's Andy Cheng. He's done pretty good.
The other thing I want to mention quickly is that the first shot of I should have mentioned this at the start. The first shot of the film is of Daniel Cedac's office building for his company, Quick Loans Funding. The first thing you see is Quick Loans Funding.
That's a point, yeah. Because when I saw that, I was like, what's that got to do with anything in the film? You know, that whole first sequence, in fact, you could say, what has this got to do with anything? But really, it's just a case of sort of showing, you know, how stupid these people are with their money, basically.
Yeah, and the high-stakes drive-in and whatever. And there's that, oh, yeah, we're going to turn off the lights and we're going to drive with night vision.
Mm. Yeah, because that always works, yeah. Anyway.
Brings to mind Rollerball. Remember Rollerball, the night vision scene in that?
Night vision. We did a whole thing on that on The Smoking Lamb a while ago. Because I love the original Rollerball, the James Caan one. I think it's a great film. And I hadn't seen Rollerball, the remake, for ages. Until, you know, ages after it had been made. And that whole night vision thing. And Andrew Mackay was sort of telling me that how LL Cool J was doing interviews saying how brilliant the night, you know, oh, so innovative during the night vision bit. When in fact, apparently what happened was is that their cameras got impounded. And they couldn't shoot. They didn't have their normal cameras to shoot with, so they had to do all of this sort of crappy night vision. This whole sequence.
Yeah, it was awful. They don't attempt anything like that in this. In this, they don't even really show anything. They just show him putting on a helmet kind of thing. Well, not even a helmet. It's like over one eye. Mm. So he's not even going to have stereoscopic vision. But I don't know. It's a silly moment in a silly film.
So I think we've suitably put a sort of a warning beacon around this film. You know, we've made you aware of its presence. Whether or not you decide to visit it is totally on you. We're not recommending it exactly, but we're not sort of not recommending it either.
I recommend it. I think it's worth a look. I'd say it's worth.
This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Worth a look, but know what you're getting yourself in for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't expect Fast and Furious, that's for sure. So, that's the end of this week's show. So, thank you to Rich for sitting in as usual.
No problem, sir.
And there'll be a link to our Short Shot perps in the footnotes. And don't forget to check out our Twitter and Facebook pages for info about each week's new DTV releases and also the DTV chart that Richard puts together each week. So thank you for listening and see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.